comforting the afflicted, afflicting the comfortable, bringing faith to the doubtful, doubt to the faithful, friend to the friendless, odor to the odorless. Calling lame radio to rise and talk. This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. So good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea, and to the hostile alien armies hovering silently in space, hiding smugly behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere. Remember, eat the Canadians first. They are much tastier. You're welcome, Canada. That's my favorite line, actually, from Deadpool 2, opened up this weekend. Saw it twice. If you like the first one, you like this one. If you didn't like the first one, you really won't like this one. But that was a great line. I won't ruin it for you, but there's a line in it. You're welcome, Canada. My favorite moments. It pulled in about $125 million, according to last report. That could change. Final numbers due in Monday morning. One media observer at Yahoo suggested that that $125 million, while great, while putting it in the top three, however, we move those numbers around for domestic and international openings and that sort of thing, that even though Deadpool 2 opened in the top three, it was still below expectations of somewhere between $130 and $150 million. And so, as this writer suggested for Yahoo, this could be a sign of superhero movie fatigue. They could be right. They offered no empirical evidence of that, just, you know, the kind of anecdotal evidence or coincidental evidence that, says it didn't do as well, and there are a lot of Marvel movies this summer. I think really there's just been one, so I'm not sure that fatigue is on the table at number two, but I mean, point taken. I think, however, if the numbers are off slightly for Deadpool 2, it has more to do with the shooting that took us into the weekend in Santa Fe High School. You know, it's just gun violence, more dead kids, and then a movie which celebrates violence and, you know, the myth of redemptive violence, which is one of those movie tropes. And I almost didn't go see it this weekend, even though I find Deadpool very funny, even though some of it's like way over the top, even for me. But I thought, well, you know, am I really in the mood for all of that with all of the blood still drying and at, you know, Santa Fe High School? And in the end, I just opted for the humor and to get out of the house. But I think that may have more to do with it than anything else. I could be wrong. I guess we'll know about Marvel movie fatigue on July 6th when Ant-Man and the Wasp comes out. I don't know what they're expecting for that. I just rewatched Ant-Man last week. I'm pretty geeked. Thank you, George Knapp, for whom I am serving tonight. I thought it was vacation time, but after seeing the story that he posted on coasttocoastam.com, I'm thinking it just might be sweeps month in Las Vegas, and George had TV duties. So GK, as we call him around the hallways in the clubhouse here at Coast to Coast, it's GK for George Knapp and GN for George Norrie. I'll keep the seat warm, but not so warm that you'll feel like it's a boundary violation. It won't be like that. George Knapp, by the way, is in the news coming up on Coast to Coast, and it's on the website at coasttocoastam.com. I'll tell you more about that in just a second. This is part two of a Mojave Mysteries joint that we first fired up last Sunday. In fact, later on this hour, we will revisit with last week's guest, ML Behrman. We pulled him back to do a follow-up on something that happened in the last hour of last week's show. There was a guy who had an amulet he said he found in the desert. We asked him to send the photos. His name was Mark. He was from Florida. We'll replay that conversation if you missed it later on this hour, and we'll talk about the photos. We posted them already at coasttocoastam.com, and you'll see them, and we'll talk about them. We're still trying to figure out what they are. The main guest is Deanne Stillman, however, author of 29 Palms, A True Story of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave. And whereas last week we talked about the spookier types of Mojave mysteries, tonight in part two, we're going to be focused on the on the violence, on the mayhem and the missing that lurks under the rocks and the dust, only to spring forward and reanimate at the slightest sign of life. My Twitter handle is at Deacon Punnett. Some of you have been asking about when I would be back again. The answer is, I don't know. I've had a great time. Coast to Coast has said that they want to get me back on the court where possible, and I say to that, put me in, coach, I don't smoke. When exactly that is, though, I don't know. So remember that no matter who is on, Coast Insider costs just 15 cents a day. You get every show on demand, and regardless of when I'm back, in the immortal words of Bob Seger, or Kenny Rogers and Sheena Easton, if you want to go that way, is we've got tonight. Who needs tomorrow? We've got crypto news and a special guest next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, we'll do Mojave Mysteries Part 2 tonight. Let's do a little crypto news first. Parkland survivor David Hogg, the kid you see on TV a lot, suggested, though, something today I thought was worthy of a revisit, that the news media should stop naming high school shooters. Tweeted that out. He said, I don't know the shooter's name, and I don't want to. If you agree, anytime you see a post with their name or face from news organizations, post, you know, hashtag no notoriety with one of the victims' names. I think this is a good point. I think he's making it wrong, but I've been saying this for about ever on Coast to Coast. I just go back to the earliest days of being on this show. I've always maintained that we should not be talking about the shooters because it violates a rule of journalism. And I say that because, and like, I've never, like, there are very few people who would agree with me on this, but it's not based on not wanting to know the names of shooters in some symbolic way or to stay victim focused. I chime with that, but the same rule of journalism should pertain to high school shooters as pertains to suicides. You know, suicides happen every day, all over the country, and you just don't hear about it in the news. You don't see it in the news. They leave, if they print an obituary, they leave out that key detail. They certainly never do stories about people who are standing over bridges, you know, on overpasses, rather, like over highways, and then, you know, threatening to jump. They don't do that. And the reason is, it's sensible. It only encourages more people to want to get that same type of attention. And I've been saying this forever, that's always written into the script of the next shooter. And there'll be another shooter again within the next week or so, unfortunately, because somebody will say, I want to break that guy's record, or that kid got all that attention, and I want that attention for my pain too. And most of these shooters, as we all know, are all going for death by cop. They're all doing some sort of elaborate suicide. And I don't know. I think we really do need to rethink that. Anyway, coasttocoastam.com has some great stories, like the one coming out of Las Vegas featuring our very own George Knapp. I'm going to read part of the copy. Fuzzy videos captured by military pilots caused a media splash over the last 6 months. Since the Pentagon's release of the three UFO videos, armchair experts have speculated that maybe the objects are birds or balloons or something mundane. But now the I-team has obtained an in-depth report prepared for and by the military, and it analyzes the so-called tic-tac UFO using the most sophisticated sensor systems in the world. Before your night is done, go look at that story from George Norrie. It's in the news section. Sorry, George Knapp at coasttocoastam.com. Well, always go look at George's stuff, right? I mean, whatever you do, do that. If you haven't lately, check out beyondbelief.com. So, you know, we should always do that. On the website also, the ancient calendar carved into stone that lay hidden for 900 years, over 1,000 petroglyphs discovered in Arizona's Verde Valley were likely, quote, a way to track time using the sun. This isn't so much a new story. The discovery was made back in 2005, but there are more details on it now, and you ought to take a look at it. It's kind of cool. These petroglyphs also play a part in the Mojave story we'll talk about next hour. But images carved into the rock at the Verde Valley site had served as a calendar or a clock. Roughly 1,000 were carved into the rock Images correspond to the changing position of the sun to mark solstices, equinoxes, and important dates. Like the last Friday in April, the petroglyphs say Secretary's Day, but then that's crossed out and it says Administrative Assistance Day carved into the rock right next to it. So, you know, they were staying contemporary. Scientists in France have created a house so small that not even a dust mite would be able to fit through the door. It's a nanoscopic construction. You can see the photo of it at coasttocoastam.com. It was created as a proof of concept by a nanorobotics team at a lab in France using these microbiotic systems. These micro houses are put together using ion guns with a gas injection. I mean, it's at such a small scale, it's hard to describe it, but let me see if I get this right. A layer of silica, so like sand, was laid down on the tip of a cut optical fiber that measured less than the width of a human hair. And an ion beam was then used to cut out the shape into the silica and giving it walls and windows. It's that small. And yet still, it would probably still get $2,200 a month in New York. Go figure. What are the movies Casablanca, A Clockwork Orange, The Exorcist, Dial M for Murder, East of Eden, Fellini's 8.5 Weeks, The Wild Bunch, Goodfellas, Dirty Harry, The Enforcer, The Outlaw, Josie Wales, The Gauntlet, Pale Rider, J. Edgar, Mystic River, and my favorite movie, most days of the week, Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven? What do all of those movies have in common? The guy who did the movie poster, Bill Gold, started with Casablanca. Dead at 97, died peacefully. They could make a movie of his life, but there's nobody alive who could actually do the movie poster, so why bother? Congratulations to Lincoln Erickson, aged 8, Rogers, Minnesota, for purifying himself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka. Link won a new boat, a new Evinrude motor, and a trailer rigged with the latest fish-finding electronics on Lake Minnetonka over the weekend by catching a 0.93-pound crappie during the Minnesota-bound crappie contest. So, you know, I'm going to say this because some of the headlines you'll read play off the spelling because it's spelled like crappie, but it's pronounced crappie. So it's just like shih tzu, right? I mean, it's spelled like, well, never mind. You know what I mean. It's like some of those words that people get really nervous about. And we are in the FCC's safe harbor, but it still makes some people, you know, a little twitchy to use any of the FCC's forbidden words on the radio anyway. Crappy not being one of them so much, but other words are. And that's what I've been thinking about this for a couple of weeks. Because coming up on July 3rd, 1978, we mark the 40th anniversary, July 3rd, 1978, of the 7 dirty words ruling from the Supreme Court of the United States. This pertained to the famous 7 words you can't say on television bit from George Carlin. Kelly Carlin is the author of Growing Up with George, a public speaker, host of both The Kelly Carlin Show on Sirius XM and Waking from the American Dream on, am I pronouncing this right when I say Smodcast, or is that just S?
It's not on Smodcast.
It's not on Smodcast.
Yeah. It's just a podcast. You can get it on any podcast.
Sounds good to me. And a one-woman show called A Carlin Home Companion. Are you still performing A Carlin Home Companion?
No, I'm not. And actually, my memoir is called A Carlin Home Companion. When my book came out in 2015, I put the show to bed. And, you know, once you write a memoir about your life, you can't keep talking about it. It's crazy. Then you become a crazy person.
So, sorry I got, like, all of your bio information wrong, but I swear to God, I was reading from a good source.
I'm honored to be here, Ian, truly.
You're very nice. So, but there's a DVD set. Did that change? You still have the DVD set of George Carlin, A Commemorative Collection. Is that out?
Yeah, no, that's coming. Yeah, it's it's very exciting. It's coming out next month on
Okay.
June 12th,
All right.
and it's like every single one of his HBO shows, and then
Oh,
we
cool.
have a bunch of cool bonus material, like stuff that people have never, ever, ever seen, behind the, stuff that like recorded at like the Comedy Store and the Comedy Magic Club here in LA, where he was working out material. So really raw kind of stuff that you never
Sure.
see my dad get to do, do. An old pilot of a
Oh, really?
sitcom we shot for
Oh,
HBO called
funny.
Apartment 2C,
Ooh.
where I play a punk rock Girl Scout.
Oh, cool. Were you his daughter in the show?
No, I was a stranger coming to the
Oh,
door as a
okay.
punk rock Girl
I
Scout.
see. So you're
And
just a
it was
like a regular.
1984. I was 21 years old. It was Bobcat Goldthwait is in it, and
Oh, I love him. Yeah.
Pat McCormick from like the Johnny
Sure.
Carson days. And
Yeah.
it's a really, and it's like never been seen by anybody because it was like a pilot and HBO passed. So,
Okay.
yeah.
So when people come up to you and they say, "Hey, I met your dad," what do you expect them to say next? Or what's the most common conversation that happens after that?
They say, and he was one of the most kindest people I've ever met.
Okay. So I met your dad a couple times.
So yeah, tell me about it, Ian.
No, he was really patient.
Yes.
He really was.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that to you is because I was watching, did you see the HBO doc that they did about Gary Shandling?
I certainly did. Gary was a dear friend of mine, yes.
Right. And he's talking about your dad and in that, and it was cool.
Yeah.
And I would say, so I met him a couple of, I had to do the intro at a, like he was coming through town and I was doing the whole disc jockey thing. And I could tell he was like so over the whole meeting of the local disc jockey, doing the photo thing, the whole bit. And he was very, very patient. And I admired that because I could tell he was so not enjoying it, but he did very well with it. And it always made me smile when I thought about it afterward. Then I thought that was pretty good because I'm sure he did that like a million times a year.
Yes, and I think like right before he goes on, he's got a certain kind of
Sure.
mindset,
Right.
but he always, his hero was Danny Kaye, and he was a little boy in New York City, and he went down to Broadway and stood outside a theater for 2 hours in the rain waiting for Danny Kaye to come out and give him an autograph. And Danny Kaye just dismissed all the people who were waiting for him in the rain. And my dad said to himself, if I ever become famous, I will never do that to a
No, it's
fan.
good.
Yeah.
I found the photo. Like about a year ago, I was going through something, and it's just me, and he just, I was very, it's a very fond memory, and so I'm glad that your memories are fond of him, and he was a good dad.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was crazy times. It was the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
And that FCC versus Pacifica thing you talked about,
Yeah.
during that time, it was so crazy in America. I mean, even kind of crazier than it is now in some ways.
Yeah.
And I was in Milwaukee, it was like the summer of 1973, I think it was, and or 72. And my dad went to play Summerfest in Milwaukee. He opened for Arlo Guthrie, and his Class Clown album was coming out later that year, so he was doing Class Clown material at a at a outdoor festival with 20,000 drunk people in the audience.
Yeah, really.
And he's using the language that he's using, and he ends up getting the promoter ended up running up to my mom when my dad was on stage, and I was a little kid. I was like, I think I was 10. And said to my mom, the cops are here, and they're gonna arrest him the minute he gets off stage. And my mom knew that my dad had drugs in his pocket too, so she went on
Boy.
stage with some water and like whispered to him, and then we all rushed back to the dressing room, and mom's like stashing the drugs and dad's emptying his pockets. And 10 minutes later the cops came and arrested him, and I watched that, and it was terrifying as a little kid because this is the Nixon era. You thinking, okay, he's going away forever. He didn't, luckily.
No.
But it was such a weird time, and it was the stakes felt so much different about different things back then, but
Well,
very intense.
this may surprise you, but I have written not the definitive article, but I spent about a year researching your dad and that story.
Oh, wow.
And I have I wrote an article about that that'll be coming out this fall, I believe, the way it's scheduled now.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. It'll be in an academic journal, so no one will ever see it, but I'll send you a copy just because you want to read it. But it's really all about how it was that the FCC made its big power grab.
Yep.
For using your dad, using that routine, and how it was that they were able to rig that court to give them the ruling that they wanted.
Yep.
And since we have just a few seconds here, I'm going to ask you if you can just hold on through the break, and I'll come back and we'll finish up that thought, because I'd love to send you this piece, and then you and I can have a larger conversation with it further on down the line. How's that sound?
Fantastic.
So hang on a second. We'll wrap up with Kelly Carlin and then M.L. Behrman coming up as we follow up on last week's Last Hour on Coast to Coast AM. So we're running those numbers for M.L. Behrman coming up just a second. We'll talk with him, and you can look at coasttocoastam.com and see the amulet that the listener mentioned in the last hour last week. And I said we were going to follow up with that, and we will. Take a look at those photos. Be ready to jump in if you want to comment on that. M.L. will tell you what he's been able to find out or not. And I'll tell you about some of the things I was doing, too. I got a little behind here because I'd taken so much time to get absolutely everything wrong in Kelly Carlin's bio that I sucked up a minute of time sorting that out. So I just asked her to hang on for a second. What we'll do is I'd love to have you back. So this anniversary coming up of this famous case, which changed everything in American broadcasting because of George Carlin. And it's not his fault. He was doing what a satirist is supposed to do. And the FCC was originally chartered to never get involved in content. And it frustrated them. And they used this famous small-time case. I mean, it was one complaint to one radio station is what started this whole thing. And your dad was in the middle of it. Did he talk about it, Kelly?
A little bit. He always felt it was an accident of history, like you said. He just was doing his comedy. It had nothing to do with him on some level. But the thing that he loved about it was that he knew that the Supreme Court justices had to listen to the album and had to listen to the bit in order. And it's in the annals. It's in the archives of the Supreme Court. And he got such a thrill out of that, knowing that here's this latchkey kid from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, from Irish Harlem, you know, who did this thing, and this material is in the history books. So he got a big thrill out of that.
Well, it's so interesting, and in a way, I mean, as a satirist, of course, he was poking the bear, right?
Yes,
by taunting the government, and the government kind of won. But there's a whole movement on now about revisiting this decision, you know, the FCC versus Pacifica case, because of the seven dirty words of people finally saying it's time to take the shackles off broadcast radio and television, because they can't compete against all of these other platforms.
Right. I mean, I was just at an American Bar Association conference, actually, where they had a whole panel about FCC versus Pacifica, and they talked about this. I mean, really, it's pretty pointless these days because it's a very narrow censorship that's going on. I mean, no one else is paying attention to this. So I think at some point, I think right now the FCC is pretty much out of the content business. You know, there hasn't been a lot of rulings lately around this kind of stuff. And we'll see. But
but they're not out of the fine business. They're not out of the fine business, which is really interesting. And they've gotten so ambiguous about what counts as a fine that it's just made all of commercial, you know, over-the-air broadcasting so jittery.
Yep.
And that's the part I'm talking about. And so I would let's continue this conversation sometime.
That'd be great.
But let's celebrate again the fact that this DVD collection is coming out, and it's going to be great. It's called George Carlin, the Commemorative Collection, and you were involved with it. You're in it, right?
Yes, and I'm one of the executive producers on it. And I also just want to briefly mention that in The first weekend of August, the National Comedy Center is opening in Jamestown, New York, and I donated all my father's archives to them. It's this
Oh, cool.
amazing $50 million project that is going on in Lucille Ball's hometown. And so there's a permanent exhibit of my dad's stuff there
Oh, that's
with
great.
a gazillion other things in comedy there. It is going to be the Cooperstown of comedy for America. So I just want your listeners to know about this. They should come the first week in August. It's going to be an amazing celebration. And my dad's stuff's going to be there forever. So it's a
Love
really
that.
cool thing.
I'm not sure how Lucille Ball would have felt about that. Of course, her politics running
It
slightly
actually,
different
it
than
was,
your dad's.
well, no, but it was her idea to have a National Comedy Center.
I know that. It's
She
great.
wanted to honor that. But yeah, I mean, Lucy, she got to take everything if you're going to take comedy, Lucy.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you so much. Looking forward to talking to you again sometime. We'll do it. I promise you, Kelly Carlin, and ML Berman will play the conversation that started it all from last week in just a minute on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So ML Behrman and I had a robust email exchange this week. That was before he disappeared out into the desert again. Last week's show, Mojave Mysteries Part One, was fun. Hey ML, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, Ian. How are you?
Good. I think in an email I had predicted to you that you would quadruple, or I hoped you would quadruple your number of subscribers to your YouTube channel. The last time I checked, you had done that. Awesome. You still deserve many more thousands of people following you on YouTube. So I
Oh,
hope to
thank you
look
so
up
much.
Mojave Mysteries. And I know you're off always on new ones, but let's go back to an old one from last week. So we are talking about both some of ML's books, but also his videos. And in the first call in the last hour of last week's show, we took this call from Mark in Florida. Roll it. Oh, you don't have that? Okay, well, for some reason, didn't have that up. But so we're going to replay that here in just a second so that people can hear. And Mark did follow up by sending the photos that he had that he said that he would. They were a little blurry. They're at coasttocoastam.com. So if you go to the website, you can see the very photos here. You can look at them as Mark on the phone was trying to describe them. And then I sent the photos to a couple of people that I knew, and I know ML's done his work on this too. So here you go. Here's Mark from last week.
We're driving. I have no idea to this day. I couldn't tell you where we were in the Mojave. So I woke up, I get out as close to the road, and I see this little red pointed object sticking out of the sand near some scrub. And I picked it up. It came right out of the sand, and it felt like a pouch filled with what I would say would be $800 to $1,000 in $100 bills, is what I imagined in my mind at the time. And I said, yep, going in my pocket, not telling anybody about it. And just as I go to pick it up, a little, I can't, it sounds so crazy. I've never told anybody. The best I could explain would be like a laser pen, but I could see the entire laser. And shot up within a split second. When I went to pick it up out of the ground, I got an extreme feeling of when you need to, one day we'll bring you back here. And so I stuck it in my pocket. I got in the car. My brother asked me what was wrong. I guess he saw it on my face. It turned out to be a crudely sewn shut little red, almost like a pillow that would go along with a doll set, for instance. It looked like a very tiny pillow that had been
Okay.
very rudimentarily on one side sewn together. Inside, the very top was what looked like somebody had tied to something firmly anchored and was making rope crudely from strands of something or other found in nature. That was stuffed on top. Underneath that was the statue, I believe, is bronze or copper. I'm not entirely sure, with a gold top that was handmade and of a little bezel that it could be a necklace could be fit through it. It was obviously made by hand, both the statue of what looks to me like an African tribesman holding two sticks with coverings over his crotch and his behind. Beneath all of that, there is very old writing in Spanish wrapped around extremely old cloth. Now, everybody, I've taken it to professors in the South Florida area. Some have told me, absolutely not, that is not South American, that is African. Some people have said, that is not African, that is voodoo. I've never been able to get any answers. It's been the bane of my last 4 years.
Okay. So, ML, we looked at the photos. Everybody's seen them. I guess we've got some people who are going to be able to opine about it here, too, coming up. That's why we gave the numbers earlier this hour. But so, ML, what do you think? What were you able to find out? Anything at all about this little statuette in the desert?
I was not able to trace it to any specific culture either. I tried, I started with Spanish. I looked at African. Now, voodoo is kind of the Caribbean area. I looked at juju, which is the African, more African school of mysticism. I didn't really see anything. The thing that I came up that looked the closest to my eye in a couple points was Toltec from South America, Toltec culture. There's the Mayans, the Aztecs, and the Toltecs. And what caught my eye was the loincloth he's wearing. It has two pieces on the hips, too. And that little picture of the other statue I found of Toltec that I sent you has the same type of garment.
Yeah.
And also the pose, the holding the sticks. Now, I can't tell if it almost looks like like a fiddle player, rubbing one stick against the other. And I didn't know, is that fire making? Is that a musical thing? Is it a bow? What that could be. But the pose and the wardrobe he is wearing were the closest match to the Toltec thing. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'd be really interested to see what this parchment or writing that was with it was. Now, Mark sent a couple more photos just within the last 24 hours that show it from a different angle and with that little headpiece off, the little ring that it looks like it was meant to go on a necklace.
Yeah.
And it actually has a bare head. The statue itself, it does that thing that looks like a hat isn't actually integral to the statue.
Huh.
I also asked him to take a picture of the bottom of the platform to see if there's any stamp marks or anything like that, and he did, and there were not.
Okay. This is very helpful.
Obviously, it's been molded, not sculpted, and that's about as much as I could find out. Object itself. Now, my interest was more in what type of this laser thing he said he saw and what type of, I hate to use the word, but paranormal aspect to it.
And more than anybody, because you mentioned it in some of your videos on YouTube, is that the Mojave has a way of making one feel as though one is having a paranormal experience almost no matter what one is doing at times because of the vastness of the desert. Yeah, it could just be some coincidental light that just came up at that exact second that he made a connection to. I sent out the photos on Twitter. So here are some of the responses I got, some of them less serious than others. Judy said, by the way, good show. She enjoyed that last week with you. She said it was hard to fall asleep after listening to it. Scott says, I believe they sell those at Joann Fabrics. I don't think so. Don says it fell off my charm bracelet. Ryan said it looks like a melty Bart Simpson. Eileen said it looks like a Mr. Magoo charm. Joyce said more like Elmer Fudd, albeit a nude Elmer Fudd. Yuck. But a guy named Old Bartender said this. So we put the photo up at coasttocoastam.com of this little whatever it is that was pulled out of the desert that Mark was talking about. He said, this looks like the mythical Brazilian prankster known as Sachi, S-H-C-I, holding his pipe. Now, here's where it doesn't look like Saatchi. He says Saatchi hops around on its only leg and delights in causing trouble. So, you know, that prankster motif we know runs through all sorts of different mythologies. We know about Loki and whatever. But
right,
he said,
Cocopelli. Out here we have Cocopelli, which is a flute player, hunchback flute player.
So that's got me thinking about any of those variations on the prankster. He said because of the side view that I had posted, old bartender couldn't tell whether this figurine had one leg or not. But other people have been making observations about it. And I think what we'll do, you know, we can delay things to the last hour. I can reopen this conversation later on. We'll do open lines in the last hour. But Aaron said that it looked like a musical instrument played by a West African, a goji. It's a one-string fiddle from Nigeria. Snakeskin covers a gourd bowl to create a membrane similar to that of a banjo, but horsehair strings are suspended on a bridge. It's played with a bow, and it's just one string.
Right,
I thought, well,
right.
that actually makes that looks pretty close to whatever it is, which we just still don't know exactly whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, as close to anything else we've been able to deduce from it. The thing that intrigues me is this bag it was found in.
And the photos are up of the bags, too.
Yeah, velvet bag and then wrapped in paper with this rope hemp-type thing with it. Now, here's the thing. The desert, that sun, you leave anything out in that sun and it'll turn to parchment within 3 years. So it could be something very, very old that, you know, has sat there for hundreds of years. It could be something that's only been out there 10 years and that sun has just desiccated it and made it look ancient.
Right.
You know.
Well, the mystery continues. We won't have to solve it tonight. We'll keep the pictures up and people can take a look at it and we can get back to that coming up in the last hour. But while I have you here, since we're going to be talking with D.N. Stillman on the way in just a few minutes about the book 29 Palms, A True Story of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the more mundane aspects of the mysteries in the Mojave. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you had a video up of the Charles Manson piece that we mentioned last week,
right?
Which is very interesting. So, there's like that part of the Manson history that not everybody associates, but they went out to the desert kind of in a way at one point to make a last stand, and they had this thing about luring people and stealing their ATVs. Do we have any idea how many people were killed by the Manson family in the desert?
No, they don't. There's been rumors for years that there's bodies still buried up at Barker Ranch, is where he was supposedly captured after his followers killed Sharon Tate and others. And that the story I heard was that some of the female members of his following, he would send into local towns to seduce people, act as prostitutes, basically, and specifically target, now this is the 60s, Volkswagen minibuses, you know, the old hippie
right.
wagon.
The dune buggy types, what they were looking
yeah,
for.
Yeah, well, yeah, the camper ones, and try and get them to come out, and then that they were killed for their vehicles, along with other loners or drug deals gone bad or whatever they were into. And the reports reached such a crescendo that the authorities have sent forensic teams out to Barker Ranch to actually sift through different areas with cadaver dogs and other things trying to find remains. And because of some weird ruled by the BLM, they were only allowed to dig down a certain number of feet, and they actually think the graves might have been deeper than that, but they thought they got some hits from the dogs, but they weren't able to turn up anything. Now, people that are into psychic phenomena report that they've seen orbs and other type manifestations up there, which they say are due to the souls or energies of these murdered people that haven't been found, and I give you that for what it's worth. But
well, it, it
scientists.
It fits the profile. It certainly fits the profile of what we know about the Mojave. And so we'll wrap up part two of our Mojave mysteries coming up in just a minute. ML, it's always a pleasure, and I wish you continued success. I recommended you to George Norrie in an email earlier, too. I hope you get back on Coast to Coast coming up soon. Got great stories. Keep collecting them because you're a treasure. But we'll pick up where Deanne Stillman begins in her pursuit of Mojave mysteries coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.